Well, welcome back. As we head into hour three, if it's Monday, it's time for Brandon Weikert. Brandon Weikert is the author of several books, including Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, The Shadow War, Ron's Quest for Supremacy, Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life. Later this year, A Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine. You can follow him on Twitter, X, Twix, at We the Brandon. He writes for National Interest. Brandon, welcome back and happy Monday, and thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you as always. It's a joy to be here.
You know, I almost never ask you about some of your equipment writing, if that's the right word for it, mechanics, materiel. But you, this is interesting. The top 10 main battle tanks in the world that you wrote about at the National Interest. You said you got a lot of emails on what you wrote about the Russian T-72. Without going too deeply in the weeds, I guess, tell us a little bit about what turned your mind to tanks and what you learned in writing about them.
Well, how it works over at the National Interest is, I have to write about four articles a day. Some of them are subjects of my own, what I want to write about, but most of them are the editorial team will pick and ask if I'm willing to write on it. And so this was over the weekend, a long form essay that I was asked to write about. And at first I kind of was like, it's not really my thing. I mean, I know about tanks, but I don't normally write about sort of the technical side, but I thought it would be fun. And in the process of researching the article, a couple of my colleagues had written at the National Interest similar articles over the last 8 months, but they sort of had different takes. And so I decided to go a different direction. You know, the original idea was that I would sort of outline what the top 10 tanks were based on their technology capabilities. And I actually said, I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I said, the best tanks are the ones that are cheap, easy to operate. If they're lost, it's not the end of the world. You can replace them easily. And I went through the list of tanks, I think, in the world that are the top 10 from least to greatest, with the number one being the most controversial pick, probably one of the oldest tanks out there, which is the Russian T-72. And now anybody who knows military technology or who served in the armed forces, in that kind of tank world, probably scratching their heads, why would I say that when there are clearly multiple technologically superior systems out there from multiple countries? But the reason is, if you look at the combat zone that currently is ripping the world apart, and that's the Ukraine war, the Russian T-72 is consistently the most used and effective, however sloppy it may be. It is the most effective platform the Russians have deployed. And I would argue it's probably one of the most effective platforms any country could deploy, because it's cheap and easy and it can be reproduced and replaced at very fast rates, far faster than anything that we have in our arsenal because of all the technological accoutrements that we throw into these systems.
It takes one stepping back a little bit to think about warfare, modern warfare. You've written about the Space Force definitively, and war in space, and all the high-tech stuff. It's kind of interesting that there is still, end of the day, a world where war still requires tanks, which have been around for, I guess, a little bit over 100 years, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Yeah, no, and I've written about that, too. And I wrote an article about 3 months ago saying that, with the advent of drone technology and with the way that anti-tank and anti-personnel systems are going, we might be looking toward the end of the era of the tank, but it's not quite over yet, again, as has been proven in Ukraine. But the systems that we would not expect to be the best, for instance, the T-72, everybody expected the Russian T-14 Armata, which is really probably technologically, if not the most, one of the top three most sophisticated tanks in the world. The Russians won't deploy it because they're worried if they lose even one of those systems, that's it for the whole program. So that's a wasting asset to me. Another system is the T-90M, which is another very advanced Russian tank that they've built over the last 20 years. The Russians are not having success using that platform against the anti-tank Javelin system and against the drones that the Ukrainians are deploying. It's the T-72 that, again, it's ugly. It's not pretty tank warfare, but, you know, it's effective in surviving these attacks and hitting back. And for me, looking at it objectively, obviously I'm not rooting for the Russians, but looking at it objectively, to me, if I were sitting in Moscow, I'd be saying, why wouldn't I be using this system? It's cheap, it's effective, and it's mass produced. And but we might very well, very soon, the way that drones and anti-tank weapons are going, we might in fact be looking at the end of the era of the tank.
Well, are we looking at the end of the era of the way we think about war? You know, I've been fascinated by, well, really ever since 9/11, I've been fascinated about the way Americans particularly, or people in the West particularly, who haven't fought in a war in a long time or seen a war in a long time, you know, whether we have stomachs for it. Material and instrumentalities of war are one thing. Our cultural composition is another thing. I assume when it comes, although feel free to push back, I assume when it comes to the material, to the physical, to the technology for the most part, as well as the as well as the hardware, that, you know, we're probably still the most lethal fighting force around. I don't know if that's accurate to say. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but our inability to understand what goes on in a war, particularly for those under 40 or 50, is what really is amazing to me. Not that we should be happy about it, but we should have more perspective about it.
Well, I certainly think on paper, the U.S. military remains the most effective combat force in the world. But in reality, I don't think it is. I think that, I think the recruitment crisis is one of many examples of just how far the U.S. military has fallen. We lost to the Taliban, and that's the bottom line. I don't really care how anybody wants to spin it. I certainly don't like saying it. But, you know, here's this highly advanced, almost $1 trillion a year now defense apparatus we pay for, and we lost to a bunch of AK-47 wielding maniacs hiding out in the mountains. That's who we lost to. Now, people can say we chose to end it and whatever, but the bottom line is we did not affect the political objective that we had sought to impose on Afghanistan, which was not only the end of Al-Qaeda, the threat from there, but also the end of the Taliban as a ruling force in Afghanistan and the replacement of it with a system that we supported. That is all gone. And so the great U.S. military lost to the Taliban. We are currently, our proxies are losing to Russia. We seem to be doing a bang-up job of trying to make our own ally in Israel lose to the Iran-backed Hamas terrorists. And China is eating our lunch in the Indo-Pacific, and that's to say nothing of what's about to happen in South America with Venezuela and Guyana. All of these rivals of ours, with the exception maybe of China, are not technologically sophisticated, do not spend as much on their defense apparatuses as we do, and yet they are at least keeping up on the battlefield with the United States and its chosen allies, which says to me that we are not doing something right. And in fact, if you look at the way warfare has gone over the last 20 years, it's not the high-tech, highfalutin systems that we've been, these legacy systems that we've been spending gobs of tax dollars on, that are making much of a difference. It's things like drones. It's things like improvised explosive devices for the bad guys. It's things like, like I said, the old T-72 Soviet-era tank that's having all of the difference, and all of these new technologies are really being negated pretty early on, which spells trouble for America because our forces are not conditioned to fight on old platforms, and we've done a bang-up job of getting rid of all of our older platforms that might be able to survive the kind of negation that's going to go on with modern systems in terms of electronic warfare and whatnot.
Yes, you put that very well, and your first sentence in that answer really sets up the stage for where I wanted to go, which is the stomach and culture of war. We lost to the Taliban, you said, and, maybe we pick this up on the other side of this break. We have to. But is it because we don't want to fight the kind of war that our enemies have no compunction about fighting? In other words, I wonder if we're too often playing by some kind of elevated level of Marcus de Queensberry rules, why our enemy is fighting to win. Can we pick up on that on the other side of this break? Thank you. Brandon Weichert is my guest, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Brandon Weichert is our guest. W-E-I-C-H-E-R-T is his name. And Brandon, I'm just bewitched by this point, and maybe I'm overly concerned about it, but maybe not. Maybe I'm over-intellectualizing it, but maybe not. When you say we lost to the Taliban, which we did, when you look at some of the other losses we've had, some people have written about it. Lance Morrow wrote about it last week in the Wall Street Journal. The understanding of what it takes to fight a war and win it decisively. I don't know if we Americans have taught it well. I don't know if we understand it. God knows it's awful and we don't want it. But, you know, I don't think that there's a time for war and a time for peace. And I don't think we're going to have nations not lifting up swords against nations anytime soon.
Right.
So do we still have the stomach for it? I don't know.
I don't know if it's a question of we having the stomach. I think it's an issue of Washington.
Okay.
You know, after 9/11, George W. Bush unilaterally went out and announced that we were not going into a crusade, and we were not, you know, we were Islam is a religion of peace.
Right.
And, obviously we weren't going to go into a crusade. And I don't think really anybody was questioning whether it was a religious war on our end. It was obviously a religious war on their end. But the fact of the matter is that here we had a man who was described as this raging cowboy, redneck, conservative. The first thing he did was go out and basically tell our enemies, don't worry, this is what we're not going to do. This is how we're not viewing the threat. And he was doing that because he was appealing to fellow elites in Washington, D.C., because George W. Bush, you know, whatever people think of him, he was not a dumb man. He understood the world he was living in, which was Washington, D.C., and he understood that the left ruled Washington, D.C. They ruled the media, and he wanted to try to galvanize support from the elite institutions. So all those speeches after 9/11 were, for the most part, not for ordinary people, because ordinary people after 9/11 were ready to burn the Middle East down, rightly so. But it was the elites who said, well, no, we can't do that. We have to worry about, you know, all these other ancillary concerns. We don't want to offend anybody. That was all elite sensitivities. And so I'm reminded of the video game, as well as now the Amazon series Fallout, in which you have this group of people who survived nuclear Armageddon, and they're all in these vaults for 200 years, and they're really soft, well-educated, but soft people. And when the real world comes down to see them, they don't know how to react, because they're not used to dealing with real people with real problems in the real world. It's all very, you know, theoretical, and they end up getting, you know, beaten up because of it. And so the same thing is with our elite who led us into the war in Afghanistan. We had Afghanistan won by spring 2002, and yet that was the moment at which big bureaucracy took over and started imposing, you know, all of these new rules that we were going to be fighting by and expanding our footprint there. And then we were starting to, you know, talk about, you know, we're going to make Afghanistan into Arizona, and we're going to do all these wonderful things at nation building. That was never what Americans wanted. Average Americans wanted to get in, destroy al-Qaeda, arrest or kill bin Laden, and get the heck out. That's what they wanted. And we had accomplished most of that by spring of 2002. That's what we call a punitive expedition. That's what the American people demanded, and instead what they got was a 20-year overcommitment that basically enriched defense contractors for 20-plus years. And so that's the kind of ideas that are running elite foreign policy, no matter who's in charge, with the exception of Trump, which is why they hated him in D.C. And so when I'm asked, you know, is it a cultural thing, I do think we've become weaker as a culture. I do think we are not educating our children properly across the board, as well as in terms of understanding warfare and when to fight and when not to fight. But I think the real problem is the separate elites that live separate and apart from the rest of us, and they're talking to themselves and each other, and they don't really care about what the people they're supposed to be leading care about or want. And after 9/11, that's a great example. We wanted blood, and instead what we got was a bunch of moral pieties. and getting defense contracts, richer, and breaking the U.S. military in the field, which is exactly what the 20-year war on terrorism has done. We did not win anything either in Iraq or Afghanistan, and the Russians and the Chinese know that, and they see it, and they're not afraid of us.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the crusade language that George Bush used once. It's a great starting point or springboard for this level of analysis. I remember when he did it, not because he said it, but because of the pushback in the editorial pages and his immediate retraction after saying it. When he said it, when he said, when he used the word crusade to describe our fight against terrorism after 9/11, I think you're totally right. I don't think anyone blinked an eye. Franklin Roosevelt, we still read his D-Day prayer. He said, we will fight in a united crusade to prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. That's how Democrats used to talk about war, crusade, right? Unholy forces.
Well, Harry Truman also.
Harry Truman.
When we dropped the bomb.
Yep.
I mean,
all
he
of that.
Said very clearly, it's Japan's fault. Japan made us do this.
Yes.
We should feel no, I mean, he didn't say this, but he basically implied we should feel no guilt for doing this.
Right.
And yet the communist left have for 70 years been revising our history so that we're supposed to feel bad because we killed some Japanese who started the war in the first place.
Right. And when we can't even use a word as, you know, innocuous as crusade, lest it offend our allies, I'm wondering if we're worried about offending the wrong people.
Yes,
right?
Especially when you look at how we've broken our back for NATO 20
right.
years later,
right.
and they haven't done anything similar for us. It's always they take, we give, under this false notion that, oh, well, don't worry, they'll pay it back. They haven't paid anything back. They're completely useless. And so my point is, you know, frankly, after 9/11, George W. Bush should have gone out and said, it is a crusade. We're going to annihilate everything. And he obviously wouldn't have meant it, but it would have put the fear of God into everybody around the world. And people would have shaped right up real quick. But instead, we had Bush constantly retracting and navel gazing and second guessing and going back on things and refining politically. And it, what it did was it meant
because the worst crime. Was not 9/11. The worst crime was Islamophobia, right? They
yes.
said that again and again and again.
Yes. That didn't come from the left. That came from the neocons.
Correct.
And George W. Bush. People forget. Now, all of that initiated in 2002 with George W. Bush. So, you know, Mr. Cowboy wasn't actually that much of a cowboy.
That's right.
I try to imagine, what if Trump was president when 9/11 happened? And I think you might have some smoldering holes in the Middle East and not any problems right now.
And you may not have had a 9/11. Let me point to something that was said over the weekend with regard to that and Donald Trump when we come right back.
Absolutely.
Kellyanne Conway was on with Bill Maher, and she said, well, Biden helped start two wars. Bill Maher pushed back. She retreated a little too quickly, but I think it's fair to say that Joe Biden did, and I'd love Brandon Weikert's views on that when we come right back. Brandon Weikert is my guest. Follow him on Twitter, X, Twix, We the Brandon. Brandon, Kellyanne Conway made a quick point the other night on TV saying that Joe Biden started two wars. She got pushed back. She kind of retreated on it and said, yeah, I probably overstated it. I'm not so sure she overstated it.
Not only did he start two wars, he's trying to start World War III in Ukraine.
Okay.
I mean, this is the problem because, I mean, you know, I'm not even going to go there. But anyway, with Kellyanne. But anyway, this is the problem, is that Trump is surrounded by a lot of people who probably are not serious about his movement. And I'm not saying her. I'm just in general. A lot of people who show up on Fox News and sound really great and show up on radio and sound really great. But when push comes to shove, all they really want to do is be liked by the left. And that is one great example of that, because Joe Biden is probably the most dangerous man we have ever had in the Oval Office in the history of this country.
That's what
period.
I think. I agree with that.
He is going to get us. Your audience does not understand because the media is covering it up. And I don't think enough people are covering it. I think you are. Very few others are, though, that the Ukraine crisis is very close to veering into a true world war. You've got the French threatening to put in large numbers of their troops directly opposed to Russian troops. I have heard from colleagues that, in fact, a French Foreign Legion unit has been lost in combat in the last 2 weeks, fighting directly against Russian forces on the front. This is not being reported. It is being covered up. That is why Macron keeps coming out talking about deploying the entire French regular forces into Ukraine to avenge the loss of this unit. And that is going to invoke Article 5. That is why you're having these massive NATO movements right now, these war games, which could easily provoke Russia into a large attack. This is why Russia is doing really aggressive nuclear drills of the like they haven't done since the dark days of the Cold War. And this is all being done under Biden's watch. Biden wants this, or at least the people who control him want this, because they think that to be a wartime president like FDR is going to get them reelected, and they are going to push this thing to the edge. So Kellyanne was speaking too softly, if anything. This man is a dangerous warmonger, and he's going to get us involved in a war against Russia that will go nuclear. And by the way, Russia has more operational nuclear forces than we do, so we will lose.
Brandon, thank you for that. We're seeing some of this, and it comes to us not because we're directly engaged right now in the battlefield, but, you know, our obvious ally Israel is. And you are seeing the claims of genocide over the dead. You are seeing all kinds of claims about the way Israel is fighting this war. And let me just remove the how do I put this? Let me take away for a moment the humanitarian pacifist element here, because I there are pacifists among us, I suppose. Not you, not me, but pacifism exists here and there. But what is it that animated the kids and the campuses to go into this genocide mode over this war in 6 months? That, yes, I mean, it's a lot of numbers. Okay, it's a lot of numbers. Let's say it's 30,000. But that's like half a year in Syria's bombing of its own people for the last 10 years every year. That's, you know, it's such a small number compared to the way every other war has fought. Why has nothing been said about the double and triple amount of dead in West Africa over the last 5 years, or Ethiopia? Why has nothing been protested with regard to how Jordan put down the Palestinians or the Syria in Hamas? You take my point.
Yes. Yes, well, I once dabbled in pacifism, but
let me take a break. Let me take a break. We'll recover from the Lebowski reference with Brandon Weikert. Let me put in a word for the stuff you have written. You and I are big fans of the Big Lebowski. Brandon Weikert, author of many books, A Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine, coming out this fall, author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life. Brandon and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Brandon Weikert is my guest, writer at the National Interest, writer of several of his own books, and author of several of his own books. We, the Brandon, his profile on Twix. Handle on Twix. Brandon, let me make sure I state this as clearly as possible. Every life, obviously, regrettable that's lost in wartime. But what is it that animated the energy that we see, the volume that we hear over this war versus seeming insouciance and blitheness towards numbers that are far greater, all within our lifetime, if not within the last 2-3 years?
Well, it's simple. It's anti-Semitism. I mean, that's
you think
all
it's
it
a double standard?
That's 100% a double standard. You look at the money that is funding these protests. They're finding that in Columbia University protests, 30% of the protesters were not even students. City College in New York, which actually a lot of people confuse. They don't realize most of these really jarring images are actually not coming from Columbia. They're coming from down the street in City College. Close to 70% of the kids, so-called, that were engaged in the riots, anti-Israel riots, were actually not students. In fact, several of the people arrested at UCLA's campus were all arrested in 2005 at the G8 summit, where they were burning down, was it Seattle? Or I don't remember what year that happened, but they were burning down the cities that the G8 happened in. So these are professional Antifa-type protesters. And the question is, where does the money come from? Well, I think it's coming from Open Society Foundation. I also think it's coming in from Iran and China. And I think that there's been some, I think the Select Committee on the China threat, I think in Congress, made some comments that they had evidence showing that there was money moving from Chinese sources to some of these protests. There's certainly been a deep suspicion that there's foreign backers behind these groups, considering that many of the people protesting are not actual students at these organizations. And then also you have the fact that it's just raw anti-Semitism, not only from people on the street who are protesting, but it's coming also from, and we've talked about this a lot before, it's coming from our liberal globalist elite, all of whom hate Israel because Israel is a successful nation state, a successful democratic capitalist state. It is not a globalist entity. There are defined, enforced borders of Israel. They have laws that they follow. It is a majority Jewish state, but it's also inclusive. You have many Arabs living there. You have many Ethiopian Jews living there. So you have a wide, you have Christians living there. You have a wide variety of people, but it is true that it is a majority ethnic religious state. And so that offends the globalists, who don't like that because they want everything to be worshiping of this idea of the global Marxist state. And Israel defies that by its mere existence. And so they are automatically antithetical to the idea of Israel, because it's such a successful country. It disproves the success or the promise of the liberal elite globalist agenda. And so that's why you see so many people opposed to Israel and so many moneyed interests on the left funding these anti-Israeli movements. And it's partly because of that, and partly because it's just raw anti-Semitism. And that's what you're seeing on display. And you're right, there's a double standard. Israel was attacked, period. They were attacked, and they were attacked not by, the Fatah, that you could make the argument, well, that there's the settlements that are upsetting in the West Bank. But that's not what happened. What happened was, it was in Gaza that the attack emanated from, under Hamas's leadership, who in turn was swearing fealty to Iran. And it was out of Gaza that not a single IDF troop had set foot in since 2005. So this idea that, the Hamas in Gaza were so agitated by Israeli policy, well, that doesn't make sense. Israel left them alone for almost 20 years. They've been able to elect their own government. And by the way, they elected a terrorist organization that is knowingly in hoc to a foreign power, Iran.
Brandon, thank you. It's easy to understand that the campus has a lot of problems. The American college campus has a lot of problems. How do you feel our country is? How do you think our country's doing?
Well, not great. But then again, we've seen examples of, like, those kids at University of North Carolina, those frat boys,
yeah,
who get a bad rap because of all these, stupid fake Rolling Stones articles about, rape epidemic on campus, which turns out to be completely false, or mostly false. You see a lot of pushback. In fact, like I said, most of the people on these campuses, or a large number of them, who are the most violent rioters of them all, are actually not even students.
Right.
They're just showing up. And in fact, I think it was at University of Arizona in your neck of the woods recently, all of the student body cheered when the pro-Hamas rioters were pulled out of a graduation ceremony because they were disrupting the graduation ceremony. And I got the sense that nowhere near a majority of people were sympathetic to the cause. They were just the silent majority that Nixon needs to talk about. So while I will go on about how things are getting worse in this country, certainly, I don't know if they're as bleak as maybe I thought they were a few months ago, because you are seeing people in the silent majority saying, you know what, we don't like this, we don't agree with this, and we're not going to let it happen. And maybe they're slow to rise, but they do seem to be kind of rising now and pushing back. And I think that in November, I think if it's a clean election, which I think the Democrats are going to do everything they can to rig it, but if it's a clean election, I think Trump is going to trounce Biden.
People don't like what they're seeing, do they? They just don't. They didn't like it in 1968. They don't like it now, huh?
Yeah. Well, even Bill Maher, who you talked about earlier, you know, as psychotic as he is on the left, Bill Maher at times sounds like the voice of reason. Yeah. He's the one who spends most of his show making fun of the left, saying that they've gone off the deep end. They're crazy. They're alienating voters, which, of course, they are. And so I think that, you know, there's no COVID going on this year. No matter how hard they try to make bird flu the next COVID, it ain't going to happen on time. And so, you know, the Democrats are not going to have the kind of crisis that they had in 2020, except maybe World War III, which they seem to be itching for over Ukraine. But even then, I think most Americans are not going to rally around the Democrats' flag the way that they assume they will, because I think the American people do not want to go to war, and they don't understand the Ukraine war because it's gotten so ridiculous. And so I think if he starts a war, or we're on the verge of a war, I think that's only going to increase Trump's chances. Trump is the only guy saying, I want peace. I want the killing to stop. And Trump was the only guy who armed Ukraine and still kept the peace with Russia for his 4 years in office. That's more than Biden ever did.
And right there is a volume of logic. Brandon Weicker, so good of you to join us every week as you do.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you, sir.
Absolutely. You too.
Thank you, man. I'm Seth Leibson, and I'll come back with a final thought. Portions of the show brought to you by our friends at YRefi. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then R-E-F-Y.com. Or give them a call at 888-YREFI-24. YREFI offers up a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, and it's not correlated to the Federal Reserve or the stock market. YREFI invests flexibility and control in you, where you can take income or turn your income off, where you can compound it, whatever you like. With YREFI, there are absolutely no fees, and you get peace of mind. There's no attack on principal if you ever need your money back, and of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. Best of all, that 10.25% fixed rate of return. Check them out at investyrefi.com. Lance Morrow, worth reading all the time. He writes at the Wall Street Journal. He's his most recent piece, The Grim Arithmetic of a Just War, what I was kind of getting into with Brandon, talking about the naivete about evil and terrorism and darkness in this world, and combine that this world does suffer too much evil, terrorism, and darkness, that the United States is not responsible for, no matter how much the left wants to foist it on us as a blight on the world, as opposed to the light on the world. Think of it this way. If we are up against evil, terrorism, and darkness, to use Lance Morrow's tricolon, if we're up against that, evil, terrorism, and darkness, we don't have to be evil. We don't have to be terrorists, and we don't have to be dark to fight it, but we have to fight it. We do have to fight it, because at the end of the day, wars are won by one side or the other. And you can prepare so that you never have to fight a war. And that was kind of the magic of Reagan and the magic of Trump. But when you think about what Joe Biden's presidency has been, what did they prepare for? When they saw to the unveiling, poor choice of words, when they saw to the forking over of billions of dollars to Iran, and when they gave signals to Russia about small incursions, and they allowed the Taliban to push us around and exit us on their terms from Afghanistan, what were we preparing for? And what are we prepared for now? That is the question we need to ask. What are we prepared for now? Thank you for spending some of your day with us. Until tomorrow, on behalf of Young David and Mr. Bill, I am Seth Leibson, and class is dismissed.